Welcome, Gladys and Potties, to the final LNL for the week, dedicated to the memory of Geeta Sereny, who died last week, aged 91. I interviewed this extraordinary writer twice on the program, the first time in 1995 about her book Albert Speer, His Battle with Truth, and then again in 1998 when her book about the child killer Mary Bell was published. She was a novelist and a journalist with two great passions, the Third Reich and troubled children. As a journalist, she had a reputation for being determined, dogged in her pursuit of a good story, and she was described as one of the most remarkable journalists I know by Magnus Linklater, who worked with her on the Sunday Times. Geeta Sereny, born in Vienna in 1921 into a family of Protestant Hungarian landowners. She was in Vienna when the Nazis marched in, and she saw immediately what anti-Semitism was all about. She left Austria for Switzerland in May 1938 and went on to a finishing school near Lucerne. Then she went to Paris, studied at the Sorbonne, and was still there when the Germans arrived. She worked as a volunteer nurse looking after refugee kids and was known to hide the occasional downed British airman. Once the war ended, she went immediately to Germany to work for the United Nations as a child welfare officer, which included looking after child prisoners from Dachau. Back in Paris, she met her husband-to-be, an American photographer, and after stints in New York and Paris, she moved with him to London. It was on the strength of an article she wrote disproving claims made by the historical revisionist David Irving, claims that Hitler did not order genocide, that Albert Speer, the man known as Hitler's architect, first got in touch with her to praise the article. He'd spent 20 years in Spandau prison and had been released in 1966. As a consequence of this contact, she befriended Speer and his wife and began her series of interviews with him. Let me quote her here. By the time we left that night, after the first interview, though knowing no details, I knew that Speer had had a miserable childhood, hated the Heidelberg house because it reminded him of it, and that he and his wife and children had always been miles apart. I knew that he was deeply nostalgic for Spandau, although I didn't know why, and I knew that he had loved Hitler, though not to what extent. What I didn't know, and wasn't to learn until much later, was that he was consumed with guilt about the murder of the Jews. It was a long time before I grew to like him, but after our first 3 weeks together, I fully believed and loved that feeling of guilt in him. So what did she receive from Speer, and what did acquaintance with him bring her?
Well, that's a big jump, isn't it? Well, what I received from him, I suppose, and gained from these not just first 3 weeks, but actually 4 years during which I knew him, and he died, as you know, at the end of those 4 years, was that he really taught me more in those 4 years about the Third Reich, and particularly about Hitler, than I had learnt in, the 30-odd years before. And I found it immensely valuable because, you know, Hitler, more than Speer, of course, Hitler still is the great mystery, isn't he, of our time?
Absolutely. He's the human black hole, isn't he?
Just
almost destroys the imagination when you look at him. Let's look at for a moment at the courageous, almost foolhardy technique that you've developed of opening up an emotional space around a difficult subject. Would you tell the listener how you approach a figure like Speer? I know that you up front tell such a character what you think of them, and so the cards are on the table.
Yes, well, that is, of course, the important thing, you know, that I always tell people, as you say, exactly how I feel about them before I start. And the reason for this is that I think it is extremely important, you know, when you go into these, because these are not interviews, you understand. These are really dialogues. I mean, we talk together. I too talk, you know, we discuss, and they always go on for a very, very long time, and they must not think that I'm their friend. they must be aware all the time that I'm there as a professional. Not more than that, but above all, that whatever they say to me will be black on white. It will be printed. This is terribly important, you know, because the fact is that, and this applies to any journalist, you know, not only journalists like me who do this special kind of thing, if you like, but all journalists. Journalism exists because people have an immense need to talk. They have an immense need to talk about themselves. And most journalism takes advantage of this, of course. You know, we are users.
Yes, but on the other hand, the subject of an interview, and I know you don't interview, but the subject of an interview frequently manipulates the journalist.
True. They not frequently, but they often try, and so do the people I speak to. They also try. You know, this is, if you like, that's expected. It's part of it. You know, but if you are very experienced in this, and of course nobody can do this. No journalist can do this unless they are really very experienced. You know, it is quite difficult to do these kind of discussions.
Well, the approach obviously works. I mean, in the case of Speer, you managed at the end to get what the prosecutors at Nuremberg couldn't get, an acknowledgement that he knew what was happening.
Yes, a reluctant one, wasn't it? And it is very interesting that he was even then unable to pronounce the words. Did you notice that? He gave me a paper to read where he had written it, which luckily, I mean, for me, if you like, not luckily, I mean, it didn't matter, but the point is nobody had... This had never been published.
But that image is so devastating, isn't it? The fact that he couldn't say it. Yeah.
He couldn't. He was totally incapable of saying it. And after he had given it to me, you may remember that this was then published in German. And at that point, when he read it in German, he asked to add a footnote and added a footnote, slightly diminishing it. At which point, of course, I confronted him. Would you like me to say the statement
that
he made?
Yes.
Well, the statement in English, more or less, I can't do it verbatim, but he said, what I regret most and always will is my tacit consent, which in German is Billigung, my tacit consent to the murder of millions of Jews. And then his footnote to tacit consent was... meaning not knowing, but looking away. And what I said to Speer then, I phoned him, and I said, but Albert, how can you look away from something you don't know? It's impossible. It is illogical. And he said, I do not wish to speak of this ever again. You see, he could not speak of it.
Before we had you on the program, I was talking about his immense ability to seduce. David Putnam, a friend and filmmaker, worked with him for some time on a feature film and found himself at the end retreating because he found that he was falling under Speer's thrall in a way. Now, you don't do that. You don't do that. But you risk a lot because you seek to find the human being behind the monster, the love within the hate. You want to extend our understanding. You are at risk, I would have thought, by this process.
Well, I think it's very wise of you to express it that way. And maybe I should be less kind to myself. I don't think I fell under his thrall. But, you know, when I say at the beginning of the book, which is quite intentional, by the way, and caused me quite a lot of trouble, when I say I knew Albert Speer well and grew to like him, of course, as you said at the beginning of this program, I grew to like his guilt. That is what I grew to like. But, you know, I did also grow to like him. I did have a relationship with Speer. You cannot have these talks with a man like this and know him for 4 years, and in fact plan to do a book with him, which I did, you know, and not develop some sort of relationship with him. You know, he knew my husband, he knew about my children, and I think that was right.
I'm interested.
I just wanted to add that because I want to be honest about it.
No, well, I think you're painfully honest about the whole issue. I'm intrigued that you're unhappy with the word evil, which is becoming very fashionable again. Let me quote a couple of sentences. To me, a man who has lost all morality scarcely exists as a human being. Therefore, a man who regains some of his morality by his sense of guilt, I cannot then call evil.
Yeah, you pick out awfully good things. This is absolutely true. You know, and people have often asked me, I mean, what is it? What am I looking for? And why do I look for these admissions of guilt, if you like? I mean, is it a kind of Christian, ethic? And I have thought about this so much, you know, particularly in the last 2 months, 2.5 months, when I've traveled 8 countries talking about the book. And, you know, the conclusion I came to, it is that I feel that every time a person can admit guilt, it takes away a little bit of guilt from all of us. Is this too... am I being too sort of,
Not for this program, you're not. I have to tell you, that's a sort of idea I like to let sort of hang in the air, but I think there's a lot of truth in it. I can remember as a kid reading about Nuremberg, and they put the prisoners in the dock through psychological tests in the hope that they would be revealed as mad. Well, of course, they weren't, were they? They passed the psychological test as people of technical sanity. And it would have been so easy to sort of to say all Nazis were all mad. But
it's interesting that even Hess passed that test. Do you remember? That was quite curious. He did not come out as mad in this test. And the other amusing thing about that, just to be a little bit amusing in this not-so-funny program, you know, is that the Speer, do you remember, cheated on the Rorschach test.
Well, that's one of the things about him. He's a very smart cookie, isn't he? He's a sophisticated...
He's a very smart cookie, yeah. And he thought it was so absurd that he would just invent things which he thought might please the people who gave him this test, you know.
Well, for him, Nuremberg was the beginning of what you describe as the great lie of his life, and that he struggled with truth, the way I suppose an alcoholic struggles with drink. And clearly,
may I interrupt you? It wasn't really the beginning, you know, because, as you may remember, the beginning was really when he found out definitively two different things. One, about the murder of the Jews, which was in October 1943, if you remember. And the second thing, when he himself saw for the first time what happened and what was being done to the slave laborers he himself, or rather who came into Germany upon his order. And as you know, 14 million people, men and women, worked as slave laborers by 1943 for the Germans. And when he found out about this, this lie began. It was then that the lie began.
Now, you accept it as a truth that he did not hear or was not aware of that famous Himmler speech in October 43?
As you know, I mean, I spent 4 months on investigating only this. I think I can say that I've read every single document in all languages that exist on this matter. And I have looked at Speer's, at Speer's situation and at the circumstances from every angle. I am not sure. That's the point. And if I'm not sure, then I will give it the positive interpretation. I think he may not have been there, but it doesn't make any difference. I mean, this means that he would not have been present at the actual speech, which was on the 6th of October in the afternoon, 1943. But on the 7th of October, the Klan gathered at Hitler's headquarters, and Speer has always claimed that he was at Hitler's headquarters on the 6th of October in the evening, having travelled there during the afternoon when Himmler gave his speech. Now, this is just possible.
Yeah, but we should point out to the listener that the point of that speech was to implicate others within the Nazi hierarchy, wasn't it?
The point of that speech was even worse than this. The point of that speech, which I think is about the worst speech that anybody has ever given, as far as I can see, was a description to the Nazi hierarchy, to the political leaders, of the extermination of the Jews, meaning that the words extermination were for the first time pronounced in front of this group. It is very interesting, and I do want to point it out, if I may, as I do in the book, that never did even Himmler pronounce the word gas chambers. So this is very, very interesting, and there's just a possibility that until Nuremberg, Speer and others did not know how these people were being killed.
Over the years... complete that thought. I didn't mean to interrupt.
The thought to be completed is, in fact, important, because one of the main points I make in the book is that millions of people, aside from Jews, were killed by the Nazis, most of them in Eastern Europe, in the former Soviet Union, and Poland. And about 2 million, just under 2 million Jews were also killed by shooting, all these people by shooting, in Eastern Europe. Now, aside from this, just over 2.5, perhaps up to 3 million Jews were gassed in the special camps in Poland in 42 and 43. But these are two different things. And my whole attempt with Speer was to get him to admit to knowledge about all these deaths. Do you see what I mean?
Absolutely. So.
Not to limit it to the Jews.
He was, of course, a war criminal even without that involvement because of his use of slave labor alone.
He was never sentenced, you know, for the murder of the Jews. He had nothing, basically, in practice to do with this. He was sentenced for the slave labor system.
One of the most interesting things about this guy, which I think is manifest in everything that I ever heard him say, I don't think he realized it was, and certainly in his own account of his life, is that he, in fact, was in love with Hitler in a strange way, and that perhaps Hitler was in love with him.
I think that he was in love with Hitler, and there was an erotic component, though not homosexual, and I think Hitler loved him. This is different, probably without an erotic component. And this is, as you quite rightly draw attention to it, it is really an incredibly important part of this, because really Speer's whole career in the Third Reich was caused, if you like, by this extraordinary attachment. And without understanding this attachment, and extended, by the way, from Speer, the attachment of really millions of Germans in a lesser way, but in the same way, to Hitler. You cannot understand either Hitler, the relationship Speer-Hitler, Speer, or the Germans.
This is a hypothesis. I just wanted people to think about it while I thought of the way of putting the next thought to you, or the next question to you. It's a nonsense in a sense. It's one of those if questions. But had he known about the final solution, do you think he was close enough to Hitler to talk to Hitler about it and to change the outcome?
No. I think that absolutely no. I think that frankly nobody could have done anything about this after the invasion of Russia. I think before the invasion of Russia, at the very beginning of it, I would venture to say that the churches could have done something. And sadly,
well, history records that they didn't make a huge effort, doesn't it?
That's right. And as you probably, if you know my book Into That Darkness about Stangl, there's a very precise account of it. Above all, the Catholic Church and the Pope did nothing. I think these are the only influences. Once that certain moment was passed, really, it was like an unstoppable like an unstoppable storm. It could not be stopped.
Hitler, of course.
And Hitler was obsessed, you know.
Hitler died an unexcommunicated Catholic, although he'd obviously renounced Catholicism in favour of his own strange paganism. What about Speer's religious beliefs?
Speer was a conventional Christian, of course. He gave up his formal attachment to the church, as many others did, and became a Gottgläubiger, which is a believer in God. That was not required, but encouraged by the Nazis, if you were in the party. After the war, or rather, after the war, in Spandau, Speer took up a very serious study of theology. As you probably saw, he read, one of the first things he did was to read the 30 volumes of Karl Barth's Dogmatic, which, believe me, I tried to read it, and it's a very difficult reading indeed.
You know, unfortunately, we have to wind it up, and I could talk to you for hours about this. Just one a yes-no answer. Do you finally think that he deserved to hang in 46?
He would have deserved to hang, and thank God he didn't, because then I couldn't have talked to him, and we couldn't have learned.
Couldn't have talked tonight, I guess. Look, thank you very much, Gita Sereny. The Albert Speer book is called His Battle with Truth. It's published by Macmillan, and I commend it to you with considerable enthusiasm.